Thanks for listening to season 4 of the Utah Real Estate Podcast.
The most downloaded series in the whole state and possibly the world.
Hello, I'm Steph Scholl here with the one and only Silver Dollar Man.
Also known as Scott Stevenson. This year, we are consulting with community leaders about the future of the Beehive State.
And how you can best secure a house for your home.
Join the thousands.
And my mom.
That subscribe every Thursday for the most exciting hour of the week.
Scott, as the population of Utah continues to grow, I mean, we're always talking about it. It really is essential to have individuals like our guest, Steve Newton, who has experience with city planning. So Steve was a two-term city council member and a one-term mayor of Sandy City in the 1980s. And he was responsible for coordinating, planning, and helping assure the city ran smoothly.
Nowadays, Steve's a corporate and business lawyer. His first-hand experience with city planning makes him the perfect person to comment on the pros and cons of the Utah growth. So, Steve, tell us, what did Sandy City look like when you started on the city council?
I wanted to get involved, so I got in the beautification committee, and then ultimately the Alta Canyon Community Council, and we dealt with planning and putting together a master plan for the Alta Canyon quadrant of Sandy City. And then when the city council completely ignored the plan we had worked on for a year and got approved, and it went through the planning commission, and it went through the city council, and everybody approved it. And then the first time there was a commercial development that was affected by the plan, the city council ignored it. I said, well, dang it, I'm going to run for council. So I ran out of anger.
An angry citizen.
Yes, that's right. And so being a city councilman was a real interesting proposition because you're dealing with the zoning issues and planning and the like. And when you start out from nothing, it was really naive. And as we got going, you found out how to get things done and how to not get rolled by other councilmen who were a little bit more sophisticated than you. And then you started to worry about, well, what really works for the city? What doesn't work for the city? What works for... how much commercial do you need? And at the time we had nothing. We had a few grocery stores and gas stations, but there was no mall. There was no major commercial developments that would really produces a good level of tax base. We were essentially a suburban community. None of the roads were connected. So from Alta Canyon, Highland Drive wasn't connected, so you couldn't get from Creek Road to 94th South. And I lived in the Willow Creek area, so when I'd go to city council meeting, I'd have to drive out Willow Creek Drive, down to 13th, then over, and then City Hall was on 8600 South.
And that would have been pretty tough in the horse and buggy day.
No, but that's interesting to hear. So it sounds like there were a lot of houses.
Lots of houses. Yeah. Housing was going like crazy. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I mean, I ran for city council in 79, so 80. And in the 1980 mm-hmm. census, we were the youngest city in the nation.
Wow.
Of any size. Uh-huh. We were the most married city in the nation of any size. We produced the most garbage per household of any nation in the
city. Because we had a lot of kids.
We had big families, a lot of kids, not enough parks, not enough. We had a huge demand for recreation space, and we had no parks. And so as a city councilman, we tried to pass a bond in 79. It would have been a recreation bond, but it failed. But it passed overwhelmingly in the Alta Canyon area. So as a city councilman, I said, okay, I'm going to try to put together the Alta Canyon Rec District where we will build 5 parks and the swimming pool and those sorts of things. We worked on that and got that passed. So it was a really real challenge because you had no tax base. Trying to build roads, we're trying to connect Highland Drive. We're lobbying the state of Utah to get money to be able to build these roads. We're trying to build them ourselves. We're trying to get developers to build them for us when it's possible, but huge gaps in our road system. Highland Drive, Wasatch Boulevard, 7th was narrow. We ended up widening it. The Ski Connect Road, as it was called, you know, you'd drive off of 90th South, you'd go east, you'd get to 7th East. It was a T.
Oh, really?
It was a T intersection. So you had to either, to get east then, you'd have to make a right-hand turn, drive to 94th, and then up 94th.
Mm. So not convenient at all for people.
No, the road system was, it was like nobody had ever thought through any of it. And it was challenging times to try to build a city with no money and tremendous infrastructure needs.
And I'll bet you that most residents don't really think about the tax base in building roads. In other words, they don't see the benefit of maybe getting all that commercial property around them as far as the tax to help them on roads.
Well, I can tell you my impression when I was not on the city council. It was like roads grew naturally.
Yeah.
They just came up and the asphalt just got rolled on there. How did that happen? I had no sense of the horrendous cost of building these infrastructure. And we had no flood control. So that was the beauty of the Alta Canyon Reg District, because we went to county flood control. We said, you've got these pieces of property. We'll build parks on them. And they said, yeah, we'll give you the land for free, but you have to build the flood control infrastructure in every one of these parks. So every one of these parks that we build in Alta Canyon are a flood control basin. So they would, and ironically, the year after we finished them, we had a 100-year storm, and those things filled up. Those parks filled nearly to the top, and we saved lots and lots of basements in Murray, because it all flows downhill. It goes into Little Cottonwood Creek, and then it ends up in Murray, and you're flooding basements in Murray. But these flood retention basins that are our parks, Alta Canyon Park, Buttercup, Falcon Park, Alta Canyon Park, the outflowing pipe, capacity of the outflowing pipe is smaller than the inflow. And so you've got this constant flow, but if the inflow exceeds the outflow, suddenly it starts to fill, and then it's delaying the draining, so you have time to drain these parks, and all those parks filled right up to the top within a year.
That's so interesting. And I grew up in Sandy, and one thing that I miss now that I don't live in Sandy is being so close to a park. Like how you're talking about the residents don't think about it. But Sandy, I feel like, is a very desirable area for people to go because there's parks, it's close to the canyon, it's easy access for things.
Right.
But then there's also a mall there, you have Shields, you have all the Health Center Theater. It's just a great location.
And all of those things, those commercial amenities are hard to get and hard to develop. And there was no 106 South off-ramp. So
that's
there was no freeway, there was no 114th, and of course, you build an off-ramp, and suddenly you've got commercial.
Yeah.
And we ended up having to raise $800,000 to put into the 106th off-ramp to speed up the state of Utah and the feds to build that off-ramp so we could get the mall that went in there, and of course, the auto mall and all that stuff.
Oh, really?
And those are huge tax base propositions that really make your budget easier to balance because commercial doesn't put demands on you. Residential cannot pay for itself because there's more demands for fire and police generated by every house than the property tax pays for. So there's a real incentive to try to get the right commercial, but then you got to get the right commercial. And if you get too much commercial, or you go too high, or you get too much density, you get too many cars, and now your life's easier for the guys that got to write the checks, but now your life's miserable because the traffic's terrible. So it's a tough balance, and you can't go overboard, and you can't put too much density, or you end up killing the goose that lays the golden egg.
Our listener, Mandy, we feel like she's our loyalist listener. If we're wrong, message us and let us know. We want to know if we have other loyal listeners. But she really wanted you on because it's great that you guys have all these people in government on, but I want to hear from someone that doesn't have an agenda. And so, like, with that, we want to know, what obstacles do you think that Utah, I mean, you talked about a little bit with, like, cities, if you do so much here, then it's with the traffic and everything, but what obstacles do you feel like Utah has to overcome to grow?
Well, growth seems to come natural. And if you look at the demographics of Utah, Utah is a place where business wants to go. Why? Mm-hmm. Demographics. And you start thinking of the demographics. The LDS community has a 3.4 children per female. That means that there is a growing youth population. Those are people who can be employees. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, highly educated. You go to other states, they've got our average for the United States is 1.7.
Really?
Okay. And if you go to China, in the big cities in China, it's 0.7. They're dying. Russia's dying. Yep. Taiwan's dying. Europe's dying. Yeah. These Asian countries are going to an absolute demographic collapse. And here's Utah having children. So that's, if you're looking to the future, you want to look at your business where you can actually have employees and have them be well-educated. So we don't need to worry about trying to get growth. Mm-hmm. We're going to get growth just based on our demographics. And then you got to deal with the problems of growth. And the problems of growth are traffic issues particularly. And it's projected that in the next 20 years, we will double our population. Well, where are they going to go? Where are the employment centers going to be, and where are they going to be commuting to? I mean, yeah, we have plenty of room out in the West Desert, but they're not going in the West Desert. Mm-hmm. Where are they going? Well, maybe Tooele County is a place of growth, but where are we going to put 3 million people? We have a population of about 3 million. I was looking at the state statistics for the United States. Utah, which used to be a tiny state, is now smack in the middle of the 50 states as far as population is concerned. So you look at our population with tremendous growth potential, where other states, California is shrinking, New York is shrinking, most of the other states are, northern states are shrinking slightly or the best holding pat. The South, Southwest, Utah is growing. And we're going to keep growing whether we like it or not. So we need to figure out how to deal with that growth, and that's a challenge. When I was mayor, I was worried about how you design your road system so you have decent parking, convenient parking that doesn't interfere with traffic flow, so you're not dealing with traffic jams. And I'd heard, Bellevue, Washington had received a great and wonderful honor as being the best designed community for traffic. And I was in Spokane for a meeting, and I thought, I'm going to drive to Bellevue and find out what's going on. Turns out it's a long ways away. But
yeah, Spokane.
Spokane, it's on the east, and then Bellevue is next to Seattle. But I drove there, and I just drove into City Hall, and I drove into the plan, and I walked into the planning department to say, well, what did you do? Why is your traffic plan award-winning? What's going on? And the planner at the time said, this is a bad time to be talking to us because we now have to figure out where we're going to get $1 billion to redo our traffic system because we overbuilt. So they had put in a system that was designed for a certain amount of density. And then downtown Bellevue, they started throwing up these high-rises. So they threw up all these high-rise buildings in downtown Bellevue without regard to what it was going to do to the traffic, and then it ruined their traffic system, and then you can't get anywhere because of the traffic. So you need to, I was always talking to Mayor Dolan when he was talking about the new and exciting things happening in downtown Sandy. I would always say at our annual former mayor's meeting, mm-hmm. Have you looked at the impact that kind of high-rise development is going to do to to the traffic patterns? And if it ruins traffic and you can't get there from there, and you turn into Salt Lake where you can't, where it's really hard to get around, then the attractiveness of the community goes away. I've got an interest in a condo down in St. George. We spent a lot of time down there. Bluff Street is a nightmare. It used to be a little nowhere town, and it was great to get around in. It was a delight to be down there. Now the traffic's terrible. So you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. How do you make growth that doesn't love itself to death?
The common citizen doesn't think about any of this because they're not educated very well. They don't take the time to educate themselves. Yeah. So all they do is complain about traffic and why it is their city isn't well planned or whatever. But there are so many facets just listening to you here. There's so many facets to that that if you don't take into account all of them and you're not well prepared as a city, then you're gonna have a disaster.
Scott, where do you go to learn this? I mean, I learned this by being a city councilman and then being a mayor. It took 10 years. Nobody's going to tell you this.
Yeah.
It's strange. Everybody has their thing. Theoretically, you should be able to rely on your planners, but your planners are captive to politics, and politics becomes captive to developers. Yeah. And so where do you learn it? You learn it by having an interest and then looking at it and say, well, how do you balance these things? And so how are we going to balance doubling of the population in 30 years? How are we going to – had any trouble getting through Point of the Mountain lately? Imagine doubling the traffic?
Yeah.
The Point of the Mountain? Our mutual friend Alan Matheson, he's in charge of developing the prison site. How is he going to do that? That's his nightmare. He knows it. He knows it's in it. He was on the Sandy City Planning Commission. He knows all this stuff. And how are they going to design the traffic so that you can get there from here instead of turning ourselves into California? My sister is in LA, and I was down. We had rented a home down in on the beach for the family down in San Diego, and I thought, well, I'll drive up and see my sister for a day. It took 4 hours to really? Drive a relatively small, what would be a 1 hour drive here in Utah. Took 4 hours to drive that. It was insane. And you think, well, look, traffic is terrible in Southern California. We don't want it to be terrible here. We need to either build the roads or – I remember Rocky Anderson, if you remember Mayor Rocky Anderson of Salt Lake City, he hated cars, and so he didn't care that you couldn't get there or you couldn't drive there. He was trying to say, well, we don't want cars, so mass transit is the answer.
But nobody seems to gravitate to mass transit.
Well, mass transit's expensive. Mass transit is helpful. But we are in the West. We're wedded to cars. This isn't D.C., you know, where you can't. And so that's where you have to decide whether you're going to. If you're smart, you accommodate cars. Otherwise, you're going to kill your downtown. Who wants to drive downtown? I don't like driving downtown. Fortunately, I don't have to work downtown except when I go to court. Yeah. So the problem then becomes if you make it hard to park and you do what Rocky Anderson was doing and you make cars miserable, all you do is kill your downtown because nobody will go there. Nobody. And now with Zoom, we've learned we don't have to go downtown. Mm-hmm. And now employees are saying, so guess what has happened to rents in major metropolitan areas? They've collapsed. But where are they going up? Draper. They're still going up in Draper. They're still going up if you have a commercial center in suburban US, the rents are going up. If you have commercial office space in a major downtown metropolitan area, dropping. Dropping because we don't have to do that anymore. Employees don't have to put up with that. And it'll turn back around eventually as we continue to grow in Utah. Yeah. It's not a problem. But what if you're in one of those, what if you're in New York? What if you're in those areas where they're losing population? Now you're going to end up, how many downtowns are going to turn into Detroit?
Yeah. Well, now are there any advantages. You can see, we can see there's this is a huge problem. You've been talking about the roads and how to handle it. Are there any real advantages to growth here in Utah that you can see?
Well, growth is nice because you can continue to raise a family. You can, your kids and your grandkids can get a job. So growth is nice. The question is, how do we manage growth so that it has the pluses and minimizes the negatives? And I think that's what we need to do. I'm not anti-growth. I think growth is just going to happen because of who we are, what our communities are. We have safe, beautiful suburban communities. And the question is, how do you ruin those? One of the ways you can ruin them is this insistence, almost perhaps even forced by the federal government, high density housing. Because they say we have to have what they call low and mod or low income housing. Well, if you force transient communities into communities, you destroy those communities. But you have to have housing. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, how? Tell us.
Well, yet cities seem to say, well, you can't have a mother-in-law apartment, or you can, but it has to meet all these restrictions. You can't rent your basement out. But isn't that the solution? Instead of a large, gigantic apartment complex, you allow rentals in basements for, and I'm not talking about rentals where you turn an entire residential house into a rental. I'm talking about allowing rentals for an owner-occupied home. So you can occupy the basement or you can occupy the top, but upstairs, but you allow a rental in the basement. Or you live in the basement and allow a rental. So that gives the young couple, the young people, the opportunity to buy a house and rent it out and then subsidize their mortgage. You still have a community. You're not destroying your community because at least half the people in that house are committed to the community. And then when the family grows, and now the family's expanding. Well, okay, you kick your renters out now, and you got space for your kids, and then you got space for your grandkids when they want to come, when they need to live in your basement. People work these things out, and they work these things out way better than government does. And in the end, that allows everybody to get their. It allows you to have the more inexpensive rental area, but they're not destroying a community in the process of doing that. And I was talking to Greg Curtis yesterday, who was the former Speaker of the House, and he said they tried to work on that, to try to do that statewide, and they got all this pushback from cities, ironically. And I don't think it passed when he was a Speaker of the House. And yet you still have what power that the federal government has is trying to force low and mod rental on people. And it's, how are they going to do it? Well, they're building these big complexes, and these big complexes don't necessarily help out your community and don't provide the stability that you actually want in a neighborhood.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think, again, it gets back to education of the public so that they would understand. Because I believe, and I live in a house that's in a neighborhood that right. Some people have their in-laws in, et cetera, et cetera. But if you gave me the option, do I want every house in my neighborhood to have the option to rent their basement out, or would you rather have a complex that's right next to you?
That's the issue.
What would they want? And everyone would say, I would rather have people in the basement.
Because that's going to fluctuate. There are going to be people in there, and then as the family grows, there's not going to be people in rentals in there. And then when you're old, you move your grandkids in, and they're taking care of grandpa.
You're sharing that house with the person. More than likely, you're going to do a good job, meaning the homeowner is going to do a good job of screening who's getting right into their home. Whereas the complex— If it's owner-occupied,
you don't want 14 college students moving into your house. That should be prohibited.
Yeah. I totally get what you're saying.
But that's a problem, because we have the definition of family, and we got legal issues where they're saying, well, you can't define family as how we used to define family. And so there's legal struggles with how you define family. And then if you turn houses into rentals, then you're destroying your community.
Right.
So it's a delicate balance. It needs to, there needs to be some flexibility, and that needs to be carefully thought through, as opposed to, well, yeah, let's just throw in another great big giant 200, 300 unit development. And now your low and mod isn't a problem because the whole community is cheap to rent because nobody wants to live there.
Do you feel like putting those type of housings maybe by, I mean, I just think of right off of 106 by the mall or like different areas like that. Do you feel like that's good in the community or?
That makes sense. If you're going to put those in, put those in into a area that essentially is already commercial and you don't have a community that you're going to negatively impact.
So would that be like the best case scenario for that type of, okay.
Yeah, and I'm not opposed to that generally. I'm just thinking the push for low and mod housing. Every time the government gets involved in pushing these things, they have unintended consequences, and the unintended consequences usually can be devastating. So we're always trying to do good things. When I was a city councilman in the 80s, of course, we went through the Reagan first term recession. So we went into the recession caused by the explosion of energy costs and explosion of interest rates. And I bought my house at 9% interest. And pretty soon money dried up for all developments. And in the city council, you weren't seeing anybody trying to develop anything except for Utah housing, high density housing. And why? Because the private lenders wouldn't lend because there wasn't a need. Private lenders were out of the business. They said, no, we're not, there's no need. But Utah housing, it had a policy, full speed ahead, throw money into the thing. So we ended up approving a bunch of Utah housing apartments, and we drove the occupancy rate to which dropped 25% and put a whole bunch of private people out of business. People that were in our neighborhood that invested in some duplexes and some apartments, and that invested just at or about that same time. And then they were driven right out of the market and into bankruptcy as a result of Utah housing throwing money at something that the private banks weren't lending on. Well, why weren't they lending on them? Because they weren't going to work, because financially they were going to fail. And so when that government starts pushing, it's going to distort the market, and soon you have a disaster on your hands. You're going to hurt. If your goal is to drop rents, well, that worked great.
Boy, oh boy, listening to you, this is the kind of thing I saw on the East Coast all the time, and the unintended consequences are devastation. But you can't even hardly say it for lack of being able to voice your concern,
right?
Because you come across as non-feeling. Unless you've been involved in that and seen the consequences of it, you think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
But then you watch it and you live in it and you understand exactly the point that you're making. But when you try to explain that sometimes to people, they have a hard time grabbing a hold of that because they believe the intention is good, which it is. But the consequences of that, there are all kinds of ramifications that come off of that, of which you're articulating.
Well, let me illustrate the disaster of good intentions. So in 2003, 2004, Alan Greenspan is saying, listen, we've got those no-doc loans going. We've got the federal government. We've got these housing agencies, and everybody else is pushing to lend money on housing and they allowed 100% loans, and because we have to help out the poor,
right.
We have to help out the minority communities, all good intentions, but what were the consequences? Well, they kept pushing this, and Alan Greenspan's warned and said to the banking committee, which was controlled by Republicans, by the way, this is getting out of control. And they're going to be, what do you call it, a little too much exuberance. And you had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. If the secondary mortgage market will buy these 100% loans, loan-to-value loans, well, okay. Good. Who cares? The mortgage company, mortgage market didn't care because they're just selling them into the secondary mortgage market. And Fannie and Freddie were packaging these loans and selling them off. And Alan Greenspan and some of the banking committee proposed the legislation that would require that Fannie and Freddie meet the same margin requirements that private banks had to meet when they're making loans. In other words, they had to have skin in the game.
Yeah.
And they said, we're going to have a regulator that's going to regulate these things. Okay, this is in 2004. Went to the banking committee. The banking committee looked at it. It was going to pass. And then good Utah senator, whose son was working for Fannie and whose former administrative assistant were working for Fannie, they lobbied him. He teamed up, put a poison pill amendment in the bill that got rid of the regulator and got rid of the margin requirements. What happened? The bill died. What happened 2 years later? Collapse of the system as all those bad loans got sold off to Lehman Brothers and you name it, and they had all these bad loans, no doc loans, 100% loans, and we have a crash. And that crash ruined millions of people.
Yeah.
So the good intentions ruins millions of people. And there's a great report from Darrell Issa's oversight committee researched the problems and what caused the 2007-2008 crash. Nobody knows that this was a senator doing when he was taken out of office in the Republican convention. He lost at the convention level. He said, there are things I regret, but I don't regret putting $7 billion into a bailout. He was roundly criticized for his support of the $700 billion bailout that, by the way, mostly got paid back. That wasn't the problem. It wasn't the bailout that he should have. And he said, I had regrets, but that wasn't it. And I agree with him. He should have had no regrets for the $700 billion bailout. He should have had regrets for killing that bill in 2004. That would have stopped the problem in the first place. And the consequences of these things aren't small. All these good intentions destroyed the credit of all these people that got these loans, and then the market crashed and they couldn't afford their loans and rates shot up. And how many people got ruined? We all know people that were ruined in that 2007-2008 mm-hmm. crash. Yeah. Ruined because government wouldn't control itself. And because there was so much interest in pushing money into communities that couldn't afford it. There are consequences ignoring financial reality.
You are very passionate about suburban sprawl.
Yes.
So tell us about suburban sprawl.
Yeah. Well, when I was mayor of a community that was Sandy City, which was the typical suburban sprawl, and we'd go to National League of Cities and National Conference of Mayors conferences. They were always talking about suburban sprawl. You're wasting all. We need urbanization. Urbanization, that's the answer to all these things. Much more efficient, much more. Well, it turns out that's a bunch of baloney. There's no, we're not, I did a calculation. If you take the 22 square miles of Sandy City and its population and you get the density, you can, at the density of Sandy City's urban sprawl, the evil urban sprawl, and you put that in and you pile it all together, you can fit the entire population of the United States into the area of the state of Oregon. The entire population of the United States in the state of Oregon. Not a single person in any other place in the United States at the same inefficient sprawl levels of Sandy City. Well, so it's baloney. There's a lot of space. There's a lot of empty space. And what you do is when you bring people together in an urban environment, a professor I had in law school, he says, what you actually get is diseconomies of scale, not economies of scale. And so the, and you can see cost of policing in Salt Lake City is way higher than it is anywhere else in the state.
And why is that?
Yeah.
Because people are so close to each other that they kill each other off. Is that so? They can't stand each other.
During the Nixon administration, there was 70s, I guess, early 70s, I think it was 68. They had an agency called the LEA, the Law Enforcement Something Administration. And they spent billions of dollars studying policing and efficiencies. And an amazing report said, they were looking for the size of police department that was the most efficient. In other words, had the most police on the ground for the size. So your total hours of policing, what gave you the most police hours in the community on the ground doing police work? The most efficient, surprisingly, police department was a police department of one. The second most efficient was a police department of two. The third most efficient was three. In other words, every time you add a person, you added complexity that took people away from policing. Because if you had a police department of one, they didn't spend their time doing reports for somebody else. They didn't report to anybody else. They just were working. They were just policing all the time. And so the bigger your police department, the bigger your layer of administration, the more people that are involved in administration, the more paperwork, the more building, the more inefficient it is. And, you know, yeah, your sewer line and sewer connections are shorter, but your traffic is a bigger problem. And so you have to build these expensive parking structures to park people, and you have to build mass transit, which is expensive, and you have to do, and so you start adding all of these things, and you get what my professor, who had worked, who'd actually worked for Freddie Mac, I think, he said, you get diseconomies of scale. You don't have economies of scale, you have diseconomies of scale. The more people you pack together, the bigger your problems. And the higher your costs per capita. So one, we don't have a space problem. Two, you don't have economies of scale by piling people together and cramming them together in an urban environment. But three, and maybe this is the most important, Utah, which is one of the most suburban states in the nation, we're not agricultural, we're not rural. We're one of the most suburban, but we have one of the highest number of children per female in the country. And our crime statistics are great, and our single mother births are the best in the country. And we have a lot of benefits from having a suburban, not urban state. So suburban. And then the biggest issue here is going back to this issue of demographics. In China, they instituted a one-child policy. That has destroyed their demographics. They're now shrinking. China is shrinking, and they don't have enough children to support the elderly that are going to be in retirement, and they're facing economic disaster. I mean, everybody thinks China's doing great. No, China is on the verge of collapse because of their one-child policy. In their major metropolitan areas, it's 0.7 children per female child. That 2.1 is replacement.
Oh, really?
2.1 is replacement. So if you don't have 2.1 children per female, you're not going to maintain your population. You're going to have a shrinking and eventually disappearing population. So you think, oh, it was that stupid one-child policy. Well, they realized that the stupid one-child policy was potential death on their culture. So they said, okay, two.
Now they've changed it to three.
Oh, and now they have a three-child policy, but not only is it a policy now, it is a responsibility to be a good party member to have three children. So guess what's happened? Nothing. Why are they still at 0.7 in the major metropolitan urban areas? because the cost of housing is astronomical in these big cities. The cost of an average apartment in New York or London is about 10 times the wage of the average wage earner in those cities. Yeah. In Shanghai and Beijing and Guangzhou, it's 40. 40 times the cost. An apartment costs 40 times. So what are you going to do? Can you afford a child? No, you can't afford a child. And children are expensive in China because you have to pay for much of their education. And to get into a college, you had this process of what they called Bushiban. So on Saturday, these poor children, they had them in Taiwan when I was on a mission in Taiwan. Your child, once it got into school, would spend all Saturday in what they called a Bushiban. In other words, tutoring. So that they were good enough so they could pass the test when they were in junior high so they could get into high school so that they were college bound. And if they failed that test, they were doomed to become coolie labor, where the term coolie comes from, which means bitter labor. And so everybody has their kids in a Bushiban, and those were expensive. Well, in order now, this last year, in order for China to say, we've got to have children, we can't do this, we can't be at 0.7, we've got to lower the cost of raising a child, they have legally banned all Bushibans in China now. Fittingly enough, Bushibans were a chief source of employment of college graduates. And so now they've got a 20% unemployment rate of their college graduate youth because they have banned Bushibans. Again, government, again. Well, and in Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan, guess what? They're all at 1, 1.2. They never had a restriction of one child policy, but urbanization makes it too expensive to raise children, and suburbanization in the United States means that we're the best situated developed nation as far as children in the next generation of any other developed nation in the world. Why? Because we suburbanized, we didn't urbanize. So this idea that cities are the best place to be, absolutely not. They're not cheaper. They're more expensive. You don't get economies of scale.
Well, can you define economy of scales for us? What that means exactly?
Well, the theory is that if you get everybody together, then you're closer together, things are closer, and so you don't have to build as many parks, you don't have to build as many, you don't have to build as many facilities, you have economies of scale. And because you're closer together, you have fewer police precincts, because you're not spread out. Your sewer connections are much shorter, because everybody's upstairs, and you got 500 people in a big apartment building, and instead of spread out over a big long period with all these like sewer connections and running all these lines and all these power lines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the infrastructure that you have to provide to live, water, sewer, et cetera, it's all compact. That should be efficient.
That makes sense, because when you talked about that earlier, I didn't exactly know what it meant. And then hearing it defined, I'm like, oh, okay.
But those that are arguing for urbanization say, oh, it's much more efficient. You get economies of scale.
I see.
Wrong. You get diseconomies of scale. The more people you pack together, the more expensive it is per capita.
Now, that's very interesting, because I think, again, I believe that the general public, and I could classify myself as somebody like that, would not believe that. If somebody explained it and you were just listening to it, oh, yeah, everything's closer, less expensive. That's what you would think.
Yeah, economies of scale. But it's not economies of scale when you're providing city services. Mm-hmm. City services are more expensive, and all you have to do is look at what's the most expensive place per capita to run government. Yeah. I mean, in Utah, yep. Salt Lake City is by far the most expensive place. And police cost the most per capita. Fire costs the most per capita. You name it. Everything costs more per capita in Salt Lake City than any place else. So it's kind of proof of the pudding. And Salt Lake City isn't that urbanized.
No, not compared
to. Salt Lake City is relatively suburban.
Yeah.
But if you want to see where all the expensive stuff is, it's in the downtown. It's in the high rises and et cetera. But you go into these mega cities, well, the cost of housing for a little tiny house with no yard, a little tiny apartment.
Is outrageous.
It's outrageous.
But when you made the point that like New York and London, that's 10 times more. And then in China, that's 40 times more.
Yes.
I feel like those types of examples give the perspective of why it's not beneficial.
It is not cheaper to live in a big city.
Okay. So my big question is that with all this growth that's coming to Utah, if you don't urbanize, how do you suburbanize with what we have? To take in that kind of growth. Curious.
That's a challenge. And if you owned all the land, it would be easy to do. You would just say, okay, well, we're putting a commercial center here, and we're putting housing around it. We're putting a commercial center. We're putting this in Grand County. We're putting this in Washington County. We're putting this in Tooele County. You know, we got plenty of space. We're not missing space. But where do you commute to, and where's the employment? And so you get a job. Well, I got a job at a law firm, and the law firm's downtown. Okay, now I got to buy a house close to downtown. And I think preference now of more and more employees is, I think more and more employees can force their employers into not requiring that you have this big, long, horrible, time-wasting commute into a city center. Because that's not where employees want to be. They don't want to waste their time on a commuting for an hour every day. They're losing an hour every day and more than that. So I think the digital age is making the idea that we have to be in urban centers. I think it's the death knell to that requirement.
My question then becomes, and I get totally the now Zoom mentality and the digital age. With that comes the other potential problem, which is the socialization or lack thereof of the workforce and the productivity aspect of that and all that. And I'm not a social scientist, so I don't know the answer to that. I've heard that expressed, that there is that potential problem. So that would solve that problem. I totally get what you're saying.
But what about nodes? You're working for some bank, or you're working for some investment or some law firm. Why do you have to be all together in the middle of downtown? How about a node? Okay. You have a small, much cheaper office space in Draper. And you live in Draper, or you live in South Jordan, and your commute is 15 minutes instead of an hour, and you're not filling the I-15 with cars in order to do that commute. And your team works together. Mm-hmm. And your team gets together 3 or 4 days a week in much cheaper office space. You're working from home. You work there. And then when you have to meet with the big guys downtown, fine. Once a month, you all trip downtown and have a lunch together or whatever. But you have the interaction. You don't have to interact with a whole office building of people. Typically, it's a team. And that way, you're going to have all of it. You get everything. You get everything that you would need. You get the advantages of being together, of interacting. And then on the occasion when you need to have a bigger group, well, you call them on the phone. I work from home, so I'm really prejudiced about the idea that you can work from home.
It sounds like these businesses and the cities, like working together, that's what helps with the traffic. That's what helps.
Oh, yeah. You solve all the problems if you're not centered in downtown.
Yeah.
Because that commuting, it's all those big buildings, it's all the high rises. Mm-hmm. You've got all these high rises where they're parking underneath that makes traffic miserable. You can't get there from here. Yeah. You can't drive there. It takes forever to get there. I-15 gets all choked up. People don't like that lifestyle. People care about their time. And, you know, how great it would be to have a 15-minute commute, and how great would it be, I gotta run, have the flexibility. My son has his Halloween parade. I gotta go there, and it's 5-10 minutes away. When I used to work in an office building, it would take me as long to commute home as it did some of my friends to get over to the elevator, down their elevator, and into their parking spot and into their car in downtown Salt Lake. So it took them as long to get to their car as it took me to get home. Now, that was great.
And I didn't like paying the parking tickets I was always getting down there.
Yeah,
that's exactly. The other thing. You park somewhere, you don't even know where you're parking. You just park on the side of the road. Next thing you know, you get down there, you got a ticket. Then you don't pay the ticket. Then they throw you in jail.
Yeah.
Then you end up being a criminal.
That's why you got a striped shirt on.
Yes, exactly. Then your friends become other criminals. Next thing you know, you're dead. It's all the steps.
That's what happens when you're downtown in an urban environment. You end up dead. Maybe you went a little farther, Scott, but you see the problem.
Yes,
we've experienced the problem.
Yes. Oh, yes.
We've experienced the problem if you had to work downtown. I used to work downtown.
Yeah.
And I would stay at work till... And I had a beautiful office on South Temple. Oh, my gosh. And I overlooked the – I was on the fourth floor, and I overlooked the governor's mansion. It was fabulous. It was fabulous. But I would stay at the office until 6 because I couldn't deal with the traffic. Mm. And so I would work later than I needed to work, and everybody else was gone. I'm the last one working. But or I'd come in on Saturday to do stuff because I couldn't stand the traffic.
Yeah.
And commuting from South Temple to Sandy was horrifying. You're seeing these office spaces in these suburban environments. The rents are going up. Because my present employment, we're in 49 states. And I sat down with our guy who manages all of our leases, and I'm saying, how are our leases doing? He says, well, no, some are going up, and some we can negotiate it, something less. Suburban office space isn't getting cheaper in spite of Zoom. So I think what we're finding is that people have the preference of not having these long commutes into major urban centers. That means urban centers are going to be dying. As they should. So, suburban sprawl, fabulous. And you can afford to raise children. These countries that have suburban cultures will persist indefinitely. Urban cultures will die.
That's pretty straightforward.
I know. I think that's a good note to end on, Steve.
I do, too. That was a great final statement. I vote for that statement.
Just a plug for all you homeowners out there. Remember, you get to choose your title company.
And here at Title One, there's a reason why there's a one in our title. Learn all about our colossal closings
by going to askusutah.com.
We celebrate with you in securing a house for your home.